Johnson, and it's July 3rd, 1999, and I am interviewing Hoang Yuan.
Correct.
For the Immigrants of Born Greenroom Oral History Project, and we are meeting in the Barnes & Noble Cafe, so you will hear overhead speakers and cash registers and other business activity. Thanks for meeting me this morning.
You're welcome.
I'm glad I'm here.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
I wanted to get started by asking you where you're from originally.
Originally, I came from the city of Tianjin in China. It's called the mainland China, as opposed to Taiwan.
And how did you make it to Bowling Green?
Okay, that's a long story. I came to this country 10 years ago, or 11 years ago, in 1988. I have to speak a little bit louder because of the background noise. And I was here because of a Fulbright grant. And my major back in China was English, and I was an English teacher for several years. And I got this grant as a good opportunity to advance my education. But the grant designate that I have to pick a subject other than English. So the nearest thing I picked was history. So I started my history major in Indiana University, Bowling Green, and got my master's there. And after that, because of the Tiananmen incident or whatever, so we got a green card. So we got to stay here, which we choose to too. And after that, I have to think, well, am I going to be a historian or something else to find a job quick, right? So at that time, the internet was just a baby, but I liked it. So I started to think of changing a career. So I choose the Library of Information Science, which is actually rated very highly nationally. The School of Library Information Science in Bloomington, Indiana University Bloomington, is recently the sixth in the nation. So I was lucky and to be enrolled in there and got my degrees by 1995. And I got my first job in a private school, K-12, and I work as a library, school librarian. It's called the All Saints Academy in Winter Haven. If you don't know the city, but you know there is a bush garden. That's the seat of that garden. And so after 2 years, I got this opportunity to come over to be a professor and to work in the a library. My first job here was a coordinator of the ERC, Educational Resource Center. And the next year I got promoted to become the website and virtual library coordinator because of my computer and internet credentials. And that's why I'm here.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
So before you went to Bowling Green, you had already been in the States for a long time.
Yes.
What were some of your first impressions when you moved into, what were some of the first impressions that you had of the United States when you first came over?
Oh, I see. That's a process of revelation at the very beginning. And before I came, someone working as a Chinese staff working in the American embassy where I have to get my visas, and he told me that once you are there, you will be surprised, and you can't be over surprised. And there I was, because the first impression, because it was a Fulbright grant. We were taken care of by a program for 22 days, and everything was taken care of, the tour, the boarding, and the food. So we were given a card, swipe it at the gate, and we eat to our heart's content. Even the dessert, they have dozens of ice cream. I thought, wow, this is what the communist says communism. You can eat whatever you want, just with a card. And that's my first impression. And of course, as time goes by, after the 22 days was over, and we were all sent to different schools we were going to, and we were on our own. And suddenly, we have been pampered, and then suddenly we were on our own. So just like a little fish in the tank, and then suddenly out here you were put into a vast sea. So I was at a loss what to do, but I have to pick up my courage and go on my life. So that's my second impression. So you have to be on your own, and so self-reliance. Yeah, that's a big trait of this country.
Mm-hmm. Now your English skills were already pretty good because you were teaching.
Oh, thank
English
you. Yeah, that makes life easier than some others.
So did you have difficulty communicating when you first moved over?
No, not very much. Actually, I impressed quite a few people. And in one of my, I think the first day in my class in my history class, Indiana University, Bowling Green, and one of the students after class came to me and asked, "Where did you come from?" Very casually, I said, China. He was taken aback. I said, I didn't mean that. I mean, where did you come from? Which region of the country did you come from? But wow. So he was impressed by my English. So I think that's a compliment.
So what were some of the first, when you're out on your own, out of the little tank and into the big pond, what
that's
were some
right.
of the first things that you had to... get accustomed to?
Yeah, I have to, for instance, I have to find where I to live, and also the next thing I find out that without a car you can't even live. So car, back in China I thought car was a luxury, so Americans were really luxurious, everybody has a car. But over here I gradually find out that for better or worse, you have to have a car to move around and to get your food, like milk. It's in big bottles. And also, the Chinese, you know, eat rice. You have to get a rice, at least, you know, a 10 pounds bag or 25 pounds bag. It's hard to move them in your backpack on the bicycle. So I think that's very hard at first.
How is it different than when you...
To have to save and to try to buy a second-hand car.
How is it different than when you were living in China? How did you go about getting milk and rice and
moving
around in China?
But in China, I live in a big city. Everything is within walking distance. So there are small shops here and there, not supermarkets. Supermarket, I think... Was a stranger at that time to the Chinese, before the Chinese economy was in this reform mode, and before China was open. So you got little shops here and there, and my mom just sent me out to just get this, get a little this, get a little that all the time. So
How was other transportation if you needed to?
The transportation in the city. I think the public transportation was the norm. When you grow up, a bicycle, and so both bicycles and the buses, it's crammed, crowded, but still it's available. So you lined up in different cities, have different habits. In my city, people are in the habit of lining up. That's great, and. So you line up, wait for, you have to time your time, get onto the bus, travel wherever you want. And the fares are cheap. At that time, people don't care whether the bus companies make money or not, because state run, the state funded it.
and
So, what were some other American cultural things that you had to get used to when you, or that you noticed when you first moved here?
And okay, another thing is that people here in this country, I think they are very religious people, and the first thing. I think the first American friend I encountered, I made, was a guy who actually was working in the capacity of something like a campus clergyman. And so he came to us and gave us Bible lessons each week. At first they came to our door, and I think at first I was kind of like resisting, because we have went through something, but it's not religion, it's the Mao cult. During the Cultural Revolution, you have to read the little red books every day, and I got tired of that, and suddenly I said, well, I'm getting into another form of that, but later on I find out it's not true. That's not true, and so I think our relationship carried on, and the and also attended the workshops or classes, either one on one or in groups, until I graduated.
So, when you were growing up in China, what were it was after the Cultural Revolution, so there was no organized religion?
Actually, this is a very, very good question, a very interesting one, too. In one of my history class, it's called the American Culture, American Studies class. It was given by a German visiting professor. It was about the Depression period of this country, and in class, I surprised the class by saying that I went through that. They all gazed at me and said, "How old are you?" I said, "Well, I went through all of that in China, because I was born in 1955, and China had the worst famine 5 years later, and I started to remember things, and I remember that how my dad and parents managed to feed us four children, and we went through very, very, very hard time. And then when things started a little better, to be a little better, and then there came the Cultural Revolution in 1996 when I was 12 years old, and I was in fourth grade in elementary school. I had been enjoying myself, and suddenly that was cut short, and all schools were banned and was stopped. And until a few years later, so we went into middle school again, but we studied nothing but the Mao's, you know, the quotations, his words, and the way, you know, kind of like treat like a religion, like a cult. And I also started learning my English, and my first English was like something like "Long Live Chairman Mao," and just the political slogans in fashion at that time. That's how I started my English. But I got fascinated to it, so I liked English ever since. And kind of lost the train of thought, right? The question was.
So they ceased schools for a while. Did they also stop religious organizations?
And, yeah. We're talking about the religion. Actually, religion in China is a very difficult question to answer. The country never, ever has a strong church like the Christian church, like the Muslim church, and Chinese, we have their beliefs. Their beliefs are not quite organized, but it's kind of like a tradition. And some people, some scholars argue that they might believe in name. You know, my father often tells us, don't do bad things, because after you die, your name still left behind. So it's like you know, like the wild geese, when they flew by, you still hear their sound. So you have to take care of what you left behind your legacy. It's kind of like that. And also some argue that it could be the worship of the ancestor. The ancestor, that's a very interesting thing. If you worship them well, serve them well, either physically by attending their graves, you know, also give sacrifices in the form of food when holidays came, and worship them to the shrine, and also spiritually, you don't bring bad reputation to the family, to smear their names. If you do these things, if you do bad things, if you don't worship them, their spirits will turn into ghosts that will haunt you. So that's one thing. And the other is the Confucianism, the Confucian tradition, but it's never become a strong church or religion. People just, you know, it's just a tradition of respecting learning, tradition of respecting teachers. They say teachers, no matter how old they are your parents. Teachers are parents of the students. And also, everything, every treasure is in the book. If you read, if you study, you will become rich. You will get whatever you want.
Is in the book?
Yeah, everything is in the, every treasure is in the book. The actual word of this proverb is, the book has the golden house.
Now, is the book something literal, or is it?
I mean,
learning in general.
Learning. Actually, because I got a badge the other day at the LA, it says library has all the treasures you want. I said, wow, what's a coincidence?
See? Coincidence.
That's right.
The book.
I think that's the idea. Yeah, library has all the treasures in the world, and the book has the golden house. It has your, you know, future. Your. But there is the anti-Confucian movements too. You know, like the Mao led the anti-Confucian movement during the Cultural Revolution, and also all along the communist movements in the country.
What were some of the major beliefs that he was wanting the people to believe?
Yeah, he wants to shatter all of the Confucian ideas. So at the same time, everything was treated as bad. So and teachers started to be disgraced. So during the Cultural Revolution, the one biggest thing is all intellectuals were disgraced. They were even driven to suicide, or literally got killed in the persecution, in the parade, public parade, and also the physical torture and mental torture. And that went on for a while, 10 years. So it just killed off a whole generation of intellectuals in China.
Well, do you have direct memories of incidents like
yes.
that?
Yes. Oh, yes. And I saw people were being bounded, and also their head were pressed low on the stage, and people shout slogans and they kick them. And also, there's one incident I remember to this day, is that a very handsome guy in my neighborhood, he had just got a very beautiful, at that time in my very young eyes. I think that girl was so beautiful, and that guy was so lucky, and that guy was so young, so handsome too. And then they seemed to be a very nice, it would be a very nice couple. And just before they got, they would get married. One day, the boy, the young guy, came upon some red guards, some young soldiers, encouraged by Mao to, you know, to revolt, to beat up people. Even though he didn't say that, but he said revolt is reasonable, something like that. They're beating someone who they think he's a capitalist. He used to have his own property or factory, you know, before the communists take over. And they was beating him up, and he said, and the young guy came by and said, stop, because Mao said we should fight with words, not with our fists. Yeah, for sure, he had that kind of quotation. And then they turn on him. And the next thing I knew is that he vanished. He was missing. And I still remember, he is the only son, only child in his family. I still remember the anguish on the face of the teary parents, and also the fiancé. That's so close to me.
Yeah.
So the only comparison I can make to about the Cultural Revolution, if I want the people in the West to understand that, I think there are only two analogies I can make. One is the cruelty of the Nazi. The other is the frenzy of the Iran Revolution. If you put those two things together, you will know how the Chinese went through for 10 years. From 1966 to the death of Mao in 1976.
And how old were you when that was taking place?
When it was 66, I was 12, and then I was 22. It's just my best years.
So you had still decided that you wanted to go on and be a scholar?
Yeah, basically. I was lucky because I was too young to join. I could be a bad guy. You know, I was too young to join, to participate in all the activities.
Or
the better words.
Did you?
I was only 12 because my parents didn't want me to. Yeah, they stay at home. Don't do that. Don't join any affiliations. But I was older enough to remember all the things. So when I, in 1975, a year before Mao died, I think Deng Xiaoping was designated to I don't know, nobody knows what was going on in the leadership, but Deng Xiaoping, who turned out to be the reformist, who led the country out of that ambush, he started to take over a little bit, and he started to redo the things, you know, to reopen the factory, the railroad, and schools and stuff. And suddenly, the next year, he was overthrown again. So I think, as I think Lincoln said that, right? You can fool some of the people all the time, all the people some of the time, but not all the people all the time, right? Before 1975, I was one among all the Chinese, all the people who was fooled some of the time. At that time, we really believed that Mao was the god. And suddenly, when Deng Xiaoping showed us the alternative, the good stuff, and then we said, wow, that's where we should go. And suddenly, when that was crushed, and people got despaired, and people suddenly see through. So that I was, you know, we were all despair. So I think at that time we had another Tiananmen incident. We had a big show of people alongside the road to saw to mourn the the deceased premier, Zhou Enlai, at that time. Actually, white people love him more than Mao. He was better, but actually I think it's kind of a silent show of dissent towards Mao, because they didn't dare to do anything. Or you can be killed. And there was a girl who just said something to criticize Mao, and he was executed. Before he was executed, to prevent her from shouting or saying things again, they just cut her throat just against a brick.
Who was this who did it?
The police at that time, yeah, under Mao. And later, of course, this incident was used to de-Mao, you know. And so I think, just to show that it was such a cruelty at that time, and it was the norm of the day. And no people can complain about it, otherwise you will have the same fate. And all that was changed after October 1976.
So growing up with such incidents around you, did you become desensitized to it?
I think I became more sophisticated. Yeah, if you went through a lot like this, yeah, that's true. So you will see things in a more critical eye. You won't believe everything. Let's say, even over here, I still have in the habit of not trusting any media. So I will read more versions, you know, all kinds to read between lines.
So when you were younger and they closed the schools, how did that change your daily activity? What did you do instead?
Oh yeah, that's good. I think do nothing. A lot of young people went astray. I think they became hooligans later. But I was lucky because my parents was very strict with me and kept me at home. And I got a bunch of good friends in the neighborhood and also in the school. So we just play around, fool around without doing any harm to society, I guess. So I think that we were lucky. We were really lucky.
Did you continue studying at home?
At that time, I was too young. And later, you know, the school was just literally closed for a couple of years before it reopened again. But all the regular classes were not installed until a few years later. So at that time, after 2 years, we went back to middle school, as I said, to learn the quotations, that stuff. And so I try to absorb everything I can lay my hands on. So I graduated the middle school with flying colors. My math is 100, my Chinese is 98, I guess. I still remember. It's equivalent to English class over here. And my English, the second language, was 100. So, because it was not very much. It just restored a little bit. So I just try to learn everything I can. So to me, that's and then in 1972, the late premier, he tried to bring the country from turmoil back a little bit, opened up a little bit. I think in 1972, the radio broadcast of English classes began. And a lot of people in colleges that didn't have much to do, professors, they came to a school where I was sent to. It's a teacher school. It's not a college, a school. Immediately after the middle school. Or another choice, I have to go to the countryside. A lot of young people were sent to the country to be farmers. So I have two choices, either go to a school to be a scholar, later to be disgraced, or to go to the country to do hard labor. I said, well, that's the less of the devil, evil. So I chose the second, to go to the teacher school to be trained to be someone to be disgraced in the future. And over there, I studied everything the first year and then the next year, as I said, 1972. And the college, the professors came to the school and said, can we teach, can we set up a training class to train them English? So yeah, okay, fine. But they have nothing to do in the college, no college students yet. So we got into a very, very intensive training. One figure I can give to illustrate the intensivity is that we remember for a while, half a year, each day we got to remember 50 vocabularies. But I was only 18 at the time, it was nothing.
So it was easy, you found it easy.
So that's how I got a very, very, I think a very good training at the very beginning. Just like a violin or a piano, if you got a good teacher, got good training, you got a very good start.
And how was your, did you get a lot of support from your family during that process?
Oh yeah, speaking of my family actually, at that time, my father was a textile worker and my mother was a homemaker because of me. She got her job with a state-run job, a security, you know, job security. Until I was in my 30s. Yeah, until I was 3, she sent me to the kindergarten where I didn't like to stay. I cried and cried until I got my ear, you know, infected. And so my mother quit her job. And later we suffered from that. It's only one salary from my dad, 4 children. And we had a very tough life in those days.
Are you the
and
youngest?
I'm the eldest. And the youngest, the fourth child, my sister, is only 6 years younger than I am. So, and we had a very, really hard time. My mother managed very well, and I think we just had the subsistence, no luxuries at all, even not a movie. And not a radio at home. So
what was the house like that you grew up in?
Back in China, actually, in the city, it's so different from here. Maybe it's a little bit like in Europe. The houses, it's like, it's just connecting one to another, back and back, and then you have the lanes. And then you have the courtyard. You went into the courtyard. You have on both sides the houses, and but all the houses are connecting to each other. There's no spaces between them. And we had 1.5 roof.
So 1.5 rooms?
Yeah, that's right.
So and was a kitchen and then a living area?
No kitchen. The kitchen is in the courtyard. It's just a stove.
So it's a community.
It's a community. You can hardly imagine. Maybe you can only see it on the movie.
So
life is so hard.
Yeah. What kind of you had mentioned? Like, how did you become aware of the different beliefs in Chinese culture if you were not taught it in school? Did you?
I think, as I said before, the disillusion came on. In 1975, that was the turning point in my life. Before, it was innocence. The innocence was dead in 1975. After that, I was more and more interested in politics, but not involved in any. And I started to learn English, and my one conviction, one strong belief is that if I learn, my knowledge will be useful. And that's the only way the society can go and myself as an individual should go. So I just indulge myself deep in myself in the knowledge of English at that time. And there was a strong opposition to that from some other people, people of my same age. They are still, you know, still fooled. You can fool some of the people.
That
That's right.
There was
That's
value
right.
That you had in
yeah.
society.
Uh-huh. I understand. I understand your question. It's a very tough question to answer because it did not spring from any of the beliefs. It's kind of like very subtle. And my mom, my dad were none of the believers, not a believer of Buddhism or Confucianism, but I think they were still in the tradition of Confucianism. But it's a very permissive, but subtle. You know, they were not, because the way they were taught. You know, the canons they were. They memorized, you know, all these are, I think, grew from that soil, but you cannot just pinpoint, just like in the Bible, on which page God says this. No. And also, especially the Cultural Revolution was the climax of the communist ideology. It's trying to get rid of anything that's non-Marxism from the minds of the people. Of course, one lecture in Indiana University, I heard from a former U.S. Soviet Union scholar said, teaching Marxism to the students actually is to teach the students to know nothing. That's true. You know, you just believe in one belief. You think, you know, in that mode, anything other than that is bad, like Confucian, you know. And suddenly, when you see everything crumble in 1976, everything Mao said was wrong, and it just got the country into a big disaster. Because of that, so I think a lot of people had a void, and suddenly nothing there. It's blank. So that's why you see a lot of dissidents came from that, and they try to demile, or you know, and then the Deng Xiaoping said, no, don't do that yet. So they just send them to jail, and then let's do the economy first. Well, whatever. But I still, because I was in that. School, I think I'm more influenced by my parents, my father's, and my father's more influenced from the Confucian ideology, like the book has everything you need in the future. Just study. So that's how I got here.
Okay. This is kind of a two-part question. So,
Go ahead.
Did your parents want for you? What were their dreams for their children to have a good life?
Okay.
And then, furthermore, then what? Mm-hmm. What are your dreams for your children?
Okay, that's a good question. Actually, my dad, as a textile worker, who used to be a farmer, and then he came to Tianjin from my hometown in Hebei province, 200 miles away, came to Tianjin to be an apprentice and then be a textile worker. But his mindset was still in the Chinese farmer's mindset, the Confucian, you know, everything. He did not have a large vision, you know, to try to be a doctor, a professor in the future. No, he didn't say that. But He asks us to be honest, to listen to the teachers, and to study well, and to be whatever you can be in the future, but not to be the get back guys. So.
Do you have relatives in the States now?
No, so far no. We have my wife, his big brother is now living in both places, Paris and Canada. So mostly in Canada, so we just went, as I said, Montreal, so went to see him, and that's also at the conference. So it's a very, very good coincidence. The business and the family thing got together, and so we had a reunion over there. Just yeah.
How did you meet your wife? Where and when did you meet your wife?
Okay, as I told you that I was sent to the school. It's called something like a technical school actually, but it's called the teacher school. It's that level between the college and the high school, and where I studied English the next year, and the next year, the third year, my wife came into the class because her dad was a professor of the Nankai University, a very prestigious university back in China. She was sent to the country to be a farmer. Because at that time, that policy was loosened up a little bit, and people started to trickle back to the cities. So long as you have the influence or you have the criteria, you fit the criteria, like your parents are too old, no one taking in to take care of them, and she fell into that category. Her father, as an intellectual, didn't have influence, and but she fit that category, so she came back. And so what to do? So she wanted to, her father wanted her to carry on the tradition of, you know, English. He was an English professor, so he and his students' friends were teaching us. So he just sent her to my class. And the first day she came, I said, wow, she was different. I just liked her. And at that time, I was one of the best in the class, and also one of the class leaders. So I was put in charge of taking care of her study, academic life. It's because she lagged behind a little bit. So I think, by and by, we just knew each other better, and her dad knew me better, so her dad persuaded her too, so both of them.
So what was your courtship like?
And the courtship at that time was also tough. That comes back to still the legacy of the Cultural Revolution and before China become so open. At that time, it was still very, very traditional, very conservative, and privacy was not known. So at that time, my wife, because my wife was 5 years younger, older than I am, we were still in the Cultural Revolution. That's in 1973. So intellectual was still suspected. So I was a very good candidate to be, you know, to be a leader, you know, in a school or somewhere, you know, to be a good guy, can't be mingled up with, you know, with the daughter of a professor, and who is 5 years older. Maybe she has some bad intentions, you know, tries to influence me. So intervention from the school, from my classmates, a lot of intervention, and following us, even know what we did, That's a long story itself.
So your classmates would be, they were the ones who were still following Mao.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Why they were intervening.
They helped the leadership of the school.
Now, how would that compare to what would just be traditional courtship, like between your parents before all of this happened?
If she was not 5 years older, if she were not from a professor's family, there's still the question of age. I was 19 years old, and that was regarded to be too young to start a courtship. And that's a violation. But if I was in my mid-20s, I think things would be much easier. At that time, even during the Cultural Revolution, the two traditional stuff like the marriage, but still, I think people have still that's still changed. Even during the Cultural Revolution, the free courtship was still, but it has to be based on politically correct. See what I mean? If I'm from a worker's family, you're from, let's say, a former capitalist family, that would be in trouble. That would be in trouble. And I would suffer from your status. Maybe our children may not be able to go to, you know, to have all the privileges other children may have. And if I'm in the army or in the police force or in the state, in some key units, even the leadership would say no, otherwise you have to quit your job.
So marriage would mean giving up your career if you worked for the state.
Yeah, that's right. If they think the marriage is not correct, politically correct.
So how did you end up getting married?
And I think the more force outside, you know, the more unity you have. So, we just hang on. And then in 1978, and the big thing occurred. Deng Xiaoping decided that, the colleges, before that, you know, before that, they opened for several years, but only the sons and daughters of peasants, farmers, workers, and soldiers, the three good statuses against the others, can go to school. They were picked, hand-picked, and sent to the school to study and paid for. And now, Deng Xiaoping said, we'll start stopping that. We'll start the reverse to what used to be before the Cultural Revolution, and what is being practiced in the whole world, the enrollment. You have to go to an exam, and then you got enrolled. So I got, since I studied in that school, I had the pre-knowledge of English. So I took the first exam. We were the first. That's in the year of 1977. So we were the year. If you mention that. The year 1977, college students, you will know, it's a bunch of students of all ages. It's kind of like something under the cover, and suddenly they let out. So people, you know, in all those years, so they used to be seniors, sophomore, junior, all came back to take the test and study. And so you can see people in their 30s or even 40s. Also, you can see people in the teens in the same class. That's a very, very interesting. But everybody treasured the moment so much, and there was no playtime. It was really, really study.
So you were serious if you went back.
Very, very serious. Yeah. Because if something was taken from you and returned to you later, you will treasure it more. Just like a people who had a near death and suddenly got her back life, and then he said, wow, life is so precious.
So So after that, pressure was let off.
We went to the college, and she failed the first exam, and then she succeeded in the second one. So we end up in two different schools, but it's close. But her family, her father's family, is still on campus of my university. So we still meet a lot. So, and later we just got married.
What was the marriage ceremony like? Was it
At that time it was a very rushed ceremony. Because we met, because our courtship went on 8 years, and we didn't have a pregnancy or stuff, but rumors went around that we got too close because her father can afford rooms, a house, and so the since her father was my department's prestigious professor, they couldn't say anything. They said, oh god, immediately after graduation, they organized a collective marriage ceremony. Two couples got together. At that time my furniture was not ready yet, so it's kind of interesting.
So what was it like? Did you
it's a very non-traditional ceremony. Yeah, dressed up in the mouse suit. I still have the mouse suit with me, and my mother bought me at that time. Not Western suit yet.
So you moved over to the States together when you got the Fulbright scholarship?
Yes, that's in 1988.
And did you already have children?
At that time, so we got married in 1982. In 1983, my son was born. So today he is almost 16. So when I came in 1988, he was 5 and a half. So he came 9 months later with his mom. Mm-hmm.
So you not only had yourself to get orientated to America, you had a whole family to take care of.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So now that you're in Bowling Green, what were some of the first impressions of Bowling Green compared to where you were before in the States?
Okay. Since I stayed almost all the time before my first job, that's 1995, in Bloomington, Indiana. Bloomington, almost to our small family, my wife, my son, and me, our second home. And we had a lot of attachment to it. And so we compare everything with it. So when we came to Bowling Green, we didn't see too much of a difference. So we like it immediately. Yeah, like our second home. So we think the size is also a university city, a town or city. But it's smaller than Bloomington. University is smaller, so it doesn't look quite much like a university town like Bloomington, but still, you still feel close.
Is there any kind of other Chinese community in the area that you...
In this area? Yeah. We have several communities. Let's say one circle is... when I was an Education Resource Center coordinator in that round building, it's called the Taipei Hall, right? Almost on each of the floor, we had one teacher of a Chinese nationality. On the first floor, we had a teacher, Dr. Tao, in the teacher education, reading. On the fourth floor, we have a teacher leadership and Dr. Wang. And on the third floor, it was me, but no one on the second floor. So we got to have someone on the second floor. So that's a little Dr. Wang would be our mentor. And then Dr. Tao would be my peer. So we kind of trying to help each other academically also in life. So especially Dr. Wang, who have been here for 11 years, gave us a lot of tips and briefings and makes our life easier. And that's one circle. And then later we knew someone from the agricultural department, Dr. Liu, So we kind of form an academic circle. That's one circle. And another circle is we got a 30-something Chinese students on campus. When the holidays came, like Chinese National Day or Chinese traditional festivals, like Chinese New Year, they would get together and invite us to. And one of the restaurants, Forbidden City Restaurant, their owners are also of Chinese nationality. So they would provide the facility, also making a little money out of it, of course, and some publicity too. So it's kind of helping each other. So we will have the celebration over there. That's one big circle too, but that's not a often, not a frequent meeting. Another circle, I think that involves my wife too. That's a Chinese community involving not only people from mainland China, but also Taiwan. So when they got together, they are just, you know, everybody look the same, have the same culture, the same language, you know, they just forget about the political differences. And so we, at first, we almost meet each, it's kind of like a get together each weekend. And later on, because one of because people moved, because the Fruit of Loom just shut down, we lost two or three people in there, so they moved out, and so the gathering just dwindled a little bit because of that.
So what kind of traditions and celebrations do you still maintain even within your family now that you're in America?
I see. And I think the biggest is the Chinese New Year.
And when does that sound like it?
Okay, that's a very, very tricky, that's very tricky because the Chinese New Year, the traditional festival, all the traditional festivals are going by the Chinese lunar month, lunar calendar. It's 30 days a month, and then 12 months a year. And then they try to put that gear on the gear to fit to the gear of the Gregorian, the Western calendar. You know, it's kind of, so if you look at the Chinese calendar, you have two, the lunar and the Gregorian. They use the Gregorian for, you know, for daily routines, go to work
business,
and then they celebrate the traditional festivals. According to the lunar month, and the lunar month has to fit into that. They would have leap months and days or whatever to try to fit, but it's fit. So it's kind of like so the Chinese New Year wouldn't fall on the same day. It would be hard. So it's kind of like moving around in the beginning between February the 6th and February the 19th or 18th, somewhere like that.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So each year it would be a little bit different, but in that range.
But it's usually always in February.
But that's when the school just gets busy.
Oh, yes.
The students came in, you know, everything. So but a celebration get together would be a one big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And also we got a satellite, satellite receiver sold from all the Chinese bookstores in this country, in big cities. You can buy from mail too. It just received several channels from Taiwan, Hong Kong, and China. Since China is free, so we just got a free one. And 24 hours. And even back in China, the biggest event during the Chinese New Year Eve is everybody is sitting down at the TV to watch a 4 to 5 hour gala of all the entertainment events on the stage. But it's beamed to 1.2 billion people.
Mm-hmm.
So you got an audience of 1 billion. So, and then we can see that at the same time.
So
that would be our big event, and record it and share it with the other people who doesn't have the satellite.
So you sometimes get together and watch the tape?
Yeah, or they just borrow the tape. They borrow the tape.
In your celebration, do you prepare certain foods? Or?
Yeah, but not tightly. We just, if we like to do it, and we'll do it. If we don't, we'll just go to a restaurant, even eat American food to celebrate. It's kind of like, so not as rigid as we were back in China.
Are there certain foods or certain things?
Yeah, jiaozi, dumpling. Dumpling would be the big thing. And also a feast.
That you would miss if you didn't have it.
We miss the atmosphere. We miss the friendship. We miss the family. You know, the kind of be close to your family. Your parents and brothers and sisters get together and celebrate it, just like a Christmas. Mm-hmm. If you are not in there, it's kind of the same feeling. The same feeling.
Have your parents come over to visit?
And no, not yet. And at first we couldn't afford them, and then later my father suffered a little stroke, and so ever since it's not quite convenient for him to move around. And he can still move around taking care of himself in the house, and so my mother has to take care of him. So.
Have you been over?
That's been put off.
Have you been able to go back and visit?
Twice. In 1994 and the beginning of 1996.
So your whole family went over?
The first time, three of us. And each time we saw huge difference. I don't know the other people, but in my family, I saw the changes just by leap and bounds. Maybe I can talk a little bit.
Yeah.
The first time, remember we live in that one little house in the alley, and you know everybody is connecting each other. The second time we went back, it's demolished, and that whole quarter of the city was sold to a conglomeration from Hong Kong. And on the phone, my sister told me, my sister is working there. Now it becomes a magnificent, big, big, huge mall. And my family was given a new, in the city, it's called a flat or apartment buildings, in the buildings. And it's like a, in Chicago, the buildings they now have two bedrooms, one big family room. They have kitchen now. They have a bathroom now. And before, they have to go out to the public bathroom. You know, you have to line up sometimes, especially for women, right? You have to line up. That's hard. For my parents, that's for so many years. And now they have everything else. And I also found some little pug. My parents had a little pug.
A little what?
Pug. A dog.
A dog? So they had a pet.
And now they have cable TV. It should be the cable. It's cable. Wow. And they have... my brother had motorcycle, they had the beepers. In two years.
They're right along with us. They've got all the same amenities.
And they have phones so we can call.
Yeah, tell me, before we started recording, you were beginning to speak a little bit about how you stayed in touch when you first moved here and how that's changed.
Yeah, that's right. That changed a lot. Before, we have to write each other. And for a letter to travel to China, one way is 7 days if it's lucky, longer if it's not. So back and forth. So you have to wait a month to see the answer.
Yeah.
And for something emergent, you can do it, right? But now you can just pick up the phone and call. Especially with the internet now. The other day I just got a, it's called a, internet card is nothing but something you printed out. The number, you dial the number, you call, and then it's only 20 or 38 cents or 28 cents a minute. So I can just talk the way long.
Oh,
yeah, I know. So it's
you're in better touch then.
Oh, yeah, much, much better. Much better.
And do they have computers?
Not my parents. One of my sisters, yeah. And also, one of my sisters is talking about, put a lot of pressure on me now, talking about sending her daughter, who is just 1 year older than my son. I think it's a 16 and a half to come to study, and they pay for everything. That's it. That's how much money they got. So wow, that's it. Don't squander your money. Get your college education back in China and try to get your graduate degrees over here, because graduate degrees, I believe, my experience tells me, it's much better.
Yeah.
Than in China, but the college level is just, you know, just party, just party. So you don't want her to party over here with her money. So just get the college education there. I try to persuade them, but I don't think I have persuaded them yet. I still have a long way to go.
Yeah.
But so it's a fashion. So when they got money, they send kids out. And yesterday from the satellite news, I just found out, it's a new thing right now. I think it's on CNN now. And China has allowed individuals to tour with their own money Australia and New Zealand. They opened that up. They already opened up to Philippines, Malaysia, Singapore, Hong Kong, but now they added two more countries. And then I think maybe in 5 years, USA, Japan, maybe not in 5 years, I don't know, 2 years.
No, so what, do you have any future dreams or plans?
Right now, I think I'm at the apex of my career. And I think right now I'm a assistant professor and website virtual library, and serving on the council of the library head, library department heads. And nationally, I got into a chairmanship of a committee, academic committee. So I think, but still, I want to be. I think in the near future, in 4 years. That's my dream, my goal, is to get tenured. So also in along the way, I have to publish, to teach, and to do all those public services, and to do my job, and to get tenured. And another dream is to save enough to bring my family back again to visit them, to see all the changes. That's in the near future. In the long run, I think I want to be a professor, full professor, in WKU, and to give more service, more of my service to the library. And that's it.
So Bowling Green's your home?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I got a house.
Yeah.
In Plano. Yeah. I like it.
Is there anything, any stories or any words of wisdom or anything that you'd like to add to this tape for future generations to hear?
Okay. One, I think if it's a wisdom. If you believe in something, just stick to it. I think you have to believe in something good, of course. Believe in God in our terminology over here. If you believe in something, you stick to it, and you work hard, and then you will get there. So no matter what the big environment is, like in my younger years, the turmoil is so, you know, it's just like a
nightmare I still pull through. And also, it's like, stay close to the family. And the family is the big support in your younger life. Because you have nowhere to turn but your family, the parents. I think I got a very good parenthood so that I didn't go astray. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.